Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg ad-free and right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg. It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist.
Madrid in Spain at the World Travel and Tourism Council's annual global summit. We actually broadcast from that summit every year around the world. Last year was Hainan Island, the year before Abu Dhabi, now Madrid. Every year when we do the World Travel and Tourism Council, we try to deal with some of the cutting edge issues in travel and tourism. This year's title is Disruption and Reinvention, and there's certainly been a lot of that. And we'll be talking about that throughout the show with many of our guests. But we also just acknowledged just last December, a 10-year anniversary of something that was truly disruptive and forced people to reinvent and redefine. It was the terrible natural disaster of the tsunami in 2004. Just a totally devastating natural disaster that affected so many people in so many ways, other than just the lives lost in terms of just the way the world thinks and the way the world moves. And my next guest, in the interest of full disclosure, is a personal friend, but also has become a beacon of hope as a result of that tsunami and what she has personally done and organized it with natural disasters and in the response to those natural disasters around the world. I call her a friend, other people call her a supermodel, but I call her something else. It's not just about looking good, it's about doing good. And that, in that case, she has done exceptionally well with her Happy Hearts Foundation. Please welcome Petra Nemkova. How are you? Was that a good enough introduction?
You're too kind, Peter. It's a joy to be here.
The story that you tell and the actual beginnings and the evolution of your fund started quite by accident, because nothing like this was ever supposed to happen. And there you were on vacation and holiday in December of 2004, the day after Christmas, I believe, when that terrible tsunami ripped through Asia. And there you were in Thailand when it hit.
Yes. I actually never heard the word tsunami before. So when everything was happening, I had no idea what was happening. And it was definitely shock. It has impacted millions of lives in many countries around the world. 250,000 lives have been lost. One of them was my partner, who I was with there on a vacation. So yes, that date, December 26, 2004, has really been life-changing for many, but I think it also made mark in the history of humanity. Most people, if you ask them, where were you that day, they remember exactly where they were and who they were with. So it was really powerful. But as you said, it's about learning what we can do differently, better, in terms of preparedness, readiness, medication, but also how we can react to natural disasters in the way that the communities can go back on their legs faster. And that's, I think, a very important subject, because there is a huge lack of sustained response. And I've seen it after many natural disasters with the foundation. We are working now in 9 countries.
Well, before you even tell me that, let's talk about the fact that here you are essentially left for dead.
Yes.
Not even expected to survive. You did survive, and the transformation that you went through mm-hmm. in terms of what can you do to help now.
Yes.
And what I find fascinating about what your foundation does is, you know, there's an immediate response after a disaster where you have to get the first responders in there to address the immediate medical and housing needs mm-hmm. of communities that have been fractured, have been torn apart. And it really is about community. And what you've done so brilliantly is realize that once the first responders leave, that's where the crisis really happens, because now people are left to try to rebuild the community that they really can't do on their own. And what you've done is to look at that and say, okay, what is the building block here, literally, of community? What's going to bring the community together and give them the strength to carry on and the ability to carry on? And it all centers around the infrastructure known as the school.
Yes.
Because when buildings are destroyed, especially schools, this is what has always brought the community together. It's in more ways than one. And so what you've done, and one of the reasons why we're doing this show today, is that you've gone out and said, okay, this is an immediate need, but it's a long-term need, and it's usually a forgotten need. Because, okay, we solved the immediate medical problem, we've helped the injured, we've cleaned up the debris, but now what? And the answer to the now what is, we need to build a school.
Yes.
And that's what you've done.
Yes, and you are explaining it so well, because when I returned back to Thailand after I could walk again, we were focusing on learning what is the biggest need, number one, and what can have the biggest impact. As you said, school is an incredible building block in bringing strength and hope to the community. It's the symbol of future. It's the symbol of hope. And even if the rest of the houses are still damaged, it gives the strength to the families to rebuild. But school works on many different levels. First of all, when you have a school to go to, children have a sense of normalcy. They can start healing from the trauma. Then with a quality school, they can get a better education, better job employment. When children can go to school, both parents, they can start working and earning living to feed their children. Then again, that gives that strength to families to rebuild the community. And then you see families from other communities migrating to this community where
they
have a school. So it helps with the economy. You see stores opening up around the school and the community, which was very damaged and unprivileged, it is becoming flourishing, a community because of school. And it's really amazing. And then it serves not just this generation, but future generation. So the impact is so beautiful. And many times we don't even know the ripple effects of that impact. But what's important is not just to rebuild the school, but is to rebuild it in a safe, disaster-proof way. Because with the increase of natural disasters, and many areas, they have recurring natural disasters, it's not just about building. It's building it in a way that it can protect children from future lost lives.
Now, you've built how many schools now?
Well, we had the dream to build one school in Thailand. And fast forward to about 8.5 years later, we have built 113 schools in 9 countries.
And still going.
Next week, I'm opening 114th school with my team. So it's been an amazing adventure. And thanks to our partners, like United and Chopard and Clinique, we've been able to really do more than we could ever imagine.
This is your captain speaking. there is absolutely no cause for alarm.
It's a motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
If you've been following the news lately, especially in the area of the cruise ship industry, you're seeing a complete resurgence again in interest in cruising. Why? Well, people have money now. They want to spend it. They're looking for different itineraries. They're not just looking for the traditional 7-day Caribbean, one port per hour cruise. Other cruise lines are repositioning their entire fleets in certain parts of the world to China for markets that have nothing to do with us. Because you've got a burgeoning middle class, people who want to spend money and they want a cruise experience because they've been reading about it, guess where, in North American media. Joining me now, the chairman of Silver Sea Cruises, my friend Manfredi Lefevre. How are you, sir?
Great.
So you heard my introduction. When you take a look at the big players, the Carnivals and the Royal Caribbeans, they've made a rather dramatic decision to allocate some of their ships to parts of the world that have never been there for a market that they didn't even know if it was going to materialize, right?
Absolutely. Well, the name of the game today is how to address the new markets, the new exploding markets of Asia, where you have 3.5 billion people who are gradually accessing lifestyle, consuming, and travel, and among that, cruising.
And they have money to spend. They want to spend it.
Growing money, and also the perception of spending money for lifestyle is increasing. It used to be that they would spend money
for material goods.
For material goods. And now they understand that once you have 10 pairs of shoes, you can't wear them all. And you start spending in lifestyle, restaurants, hotels, travel.
And, you know, when you talk about that luxury lifestyle, it's the same thing. I love watches. I'm a watch geek. But I had to come up to a point where I had to realize I'd reached the point of diminishing returns. I only have two wrists. How many watches can I own? So people are making decisions like that, but they're also, it's even more dramatic in terms of the changes. When I was growing up, what did I want? I wanted a car. The kids grew up to want to have their first car. Talk to kids today. They don't want a car. They'll use a car if they need a car. They'll rent it from Zipcar for 2 hours, but they don't want to own the car. They want to own the experience.
Absolutely. Well, in my experience of life, I've turned from being an owner of things, objects, watches, cars, to being a consumer. I like to use things. So I don't care for owning things. I like to have use them, and more of everything, I want to have experiences. So I think I'm the profile of what is the ideal target for a Silver Sea.
All right, well, let's talk about your cruise line, because you don't have 50 ships. You have how many?
For the time being, only 8.
Yes, but you've distributed them geographically in different ways. You have your core group of ships that do very beautiful lifestyle-oriented trips to ports that really lend themselves to that. And then you've got your expedition ships.
Well, we have two ships, classic fleet and expedition ships. The difference being fundamentally that expedition ships go to very remote destinations, and they have not tenders, but have zodiacs to explore the sea around them. And they're smaller ships,
But your ships in general, Manfredi, are not 6,000-passenger ships.
But even within my company, the expedition ships are smaller.
Yeah.
Today's luxury cruise arrives up to 600, some say 700. To me, it's maximum 600 passengers. In the expedition, it's smaller because you need to have access for all the people to the zodiacs to go ashore and in areas where the access of passengers is restricted, like the polar zones.
To me, one of the definitions of luxury is when you get rid of the symbol called the asterisk. Your cruises are all-inclusive. And what I mean by that is you're not always going to your wallet to buy a drink or have an ice cream. Whatever you're paying, it may be higher than other rates, but you don't feel like you're being nickel and dimed. And I think we're seeing that change now in the industry as people are getting smart about it's not what it costs, it's what it's worth. It's about value.
It's about value, and it's also about convenience. So I think the fundamental thing is the perception that you're like in a club. you go and you sit around the bar, and some people sit around the bar, and everybody orders to drink.
Right.
Nobody wants to be stuck with the bill.
Right.
And so this facilitates people getting together and mingling, and you don't have to think all the time, do I want a whiskey, don't I want a whiskey? If I order a whiskey, who's going to pay for the whiskey? If I got up, please let me sign the check. It facilitates the life, and that's a convenience factor.
So basically, your entire advertising motto is cruise with us and nobody gets stuck with the check.
Exactly, but that's a good model also. Nobody gets stuck, and you don't have to decide all the time, do I want to spend, don't I want to spend? You've made your decision, and you're not going to, you know, when you have drinks included, you're not going to be charged 3 times the cost like it happens wherever you order a drink or a bottle of wine.
And your consumption is interesting. People have a very interesting psychological response to all-inclusive. The very first day they're at a resort or on a cruise ship, they might eat more than they would, or they might drink more, but by the second day, no. They're more, you know...
Well, this is a well-known profile.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
My next guest is a regular on our show and an old friend. We go back many, many years, but stands in a pivotal position when it comes to world travel and tourism. He runs the UN World Travel Organization, and his name is Taleb Rifai. How are you, sir?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You and I have seen each other in capitals around the world for years, talking about the impact and the importance of travel and tourism. But it would seem to me that you're finally having some impact with world leaders and getting them to understand that power.
You're absolutely correct. We do go a long way, and we did have an impact in the last few years. Not enough yet. We still need to keep going on. Just to give you an example, in the last 3 years, since 2011, we have met 73 presidents and prime ministers, heads of states and heads of governments, to try and raise awareness in mainstreaming tourism in their national agenda. And the impact has been noticed and seen all over the world, not just in the developed countries.
I guess the connectivity that you're trying to achieve is to let them realize that this is not just, you know, an avocation. This is serious bottom line revenue, jobs, stability that they otherwise could not get.
Peter, it's the oil that never runs out. You get out of it as much as you put into it, and even more. So you're absolutely correct. I don't want to go into figures and numbers, but the tremendous ability of tourism to create jobs, it's a people's industry. Not only direct jobs, but drops down the value chain, indirect jobs, stimulate the economy, create pride in the minds and in the hearts of people, improve the country's image, you name it. It's all benefits if you manage it right.
You know, you take a look at all the conflicts around the world, of which, you know, we see this every day, and some of it's not getting better. But if you take a look at some of the countries that were always considered difficult, you know, North Korea, Cuba, and others, and you take a look at their GDP, and you take a look at what they stand to benefit from, you have a conclusion that's almost, you know, incontrovertible, that what's going to save the North Korean economy in the end. It's got to be travel and tourism. What do they produce that the world consumes in volume? Answer, nothing, right? If you look at Cuba, people, oh, it's sugar and it's cigars. No, it's not. It's mm-hmm. travel and tourism.
You're absolutely correct. Look, Peter, as a UN agency, our duty, our mission is to engage, even with countries that are difficult, as you may have noted. And they're beginning to turn around and see that their engagement is going to be benefiting and reflecting itself well on the country and on the people. And you're absolutely correct. Many of these countries, even countries that assume and think and realize that they have natural assets and oil and or minerals or mining or all of this, they're beginning to realize that this is not lasting, this is not sustainable. Tourism is.
And then you take a look at a country like Egypt, which depends so much to put food on the table for their people, to create jobs on travel and tourism. It's the one portfolio they don't ever want to mess with because That's their economy when you think about
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. In my last meeting with the president of Egypt, that's what he told me. He said, don't misunderstand me. This is one of the most important portfolios I've ever had. Well, I mean, look at that. 14-15% of Egypt's GDP is from travel and tourism. They get more
If it's working.
Well, it does work. Yeah. It does work. And that's what's the important point, that even though there are challenges and there are some security measures that affect security incidents that happen every now and then, because there is a political will believing that tourism is important, and because there is roots and traditions amongst the private sector and the businesses that tourism is there to stay, it bounces back quickly. It recovers so quickly. Look, I mean, Egypt's record is an example of how many times it was hit and how many more times it woke up again and said, no, I'm not giving up.
Right. I mean, I tend to think, and I mean, you're Jordanian. You and I met when you were basically Minister of Tourism of Jordan.
That's correct.
Even though you're now based here in Madrid. And you look at the Palestinian situation in the Middle East, you'd have to think that if they were looking for a way to achieve peace, a lasting peace, it has to be based on economics. And if you base it on economics, the obvious choice would be travel and tourism.
Look, Peter, in 1995, I was in a different capacity. I wasn't Minister of Tourism. I was a diplomat based in Washington, D.C. And I take pride in saying that I was part of what led eventually to the peace treaty between Jordan and Israel. The minute that treaty was signed in 1994-95, the first sector that bounced back, the first sector that reacted positively to this was travel and tourism. Immediately.
The money flowed.
Absolutely. Immediately, you have a tour operator from Israel, a hotel owner in Bethlehem or in Jericho.
And they're meeting.
And a bus owner company in Jordan that came together in 1 to 2 months, and they created a coalition. It's an industry that not only contributes to tourism, but interacts to peace. But it interacts so positively when the first signs of hope and optimism rise in the horizon.
So that brings me back to our very first discussion, and that is, what's your biggest challenge right now? What can you do?
There are immediate challenges and there are long-term challenges. I think long-term challenges are clear. Long-term challenge will always be sustainability and the responsibility of this sector vis-a-vis planet and people to make sure that this is turned to a force for good. This is a challenge that will continue to be with us because it's a management and political challenge. But the immediate challenges definitely can be summed up in two, maybe three maximum. One, which is rising up very quickly, which is security, without doubt. How do we maintain security while keeping travel friendly, easy, pleasant, and an experience that we keep remembering? And we can do that. We shouldn't compromise one for the sake of the other. But the second challenge is definitely the technological challenge. We're faced now with an ever-changing world that is driven by technology. But then it can connect to the first challenge.
Sure.
Because we are underutilizing technology to make travel easy, safe, and pleasant.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Destination around the globe, but he's here with me now in Madrid, the president of the U.S. Travel Association, Roger Dow. How are you, sir?
Hey, great to be here. Great to be in Madrid.
Now, at the WTTC, it's a great group of, it's sort of like the G20 summit, if you will, of the major stakeholders in the industry. You have airlines, you have hotels, you have cruise lines, you have tour operators, you have countries themselves and their ministers, you have heads of state. King of Spain was here last night. And yet, everybody at dinner last night was talking about what? Open skies. And the argument that the United States should change the rules because the United States Airlines, meaning Delta, United, and American to be in particular, feel that they're at a competitive disadvantage because people can fly to the United States as often as they want. That's their argument.
Well, their argument is that the Gulf carriers have been...
In particular, have been
subsidized by their government. And no surprise, so have our carriers been subsidized by our government. But they ignore that. And what they want to do is break open these agreements. There's 114 of them, Peter, called Open Skies. And it's a very slippery slope. We break open one agreement, then the next, and that gets to what does the United States stand for?
But what does open skies mean? Explain.
What open skies means, it's very simple. It's two countries get together, let's say Spain and the U.S., and they have an open skies agreement, which means that their carriers can fly to the U.S.
To any cities, to any cities in the U.S.
To any city in the U.S., and our carriers can fly to any city in Spain. And that the government can't restrict their ability to fly there and can't set prices. And that's it. It opens up the skies for travel between two countries.
So it's different than the traditional bilateral agreement, which specifies how many seats you could have, how many routes you could have, with a certain amount of reciprocity.
Right. It's very different. The carriers can come in, and a lot of these carriers are bringing the new, much larger planes with many more people. And when you look at the growth of international visitation to the United States, it's going to go up by 40% in the next 5 years.
And the thing about open skies, and you mentioned it, but I think it bears repeating, is that once an open skies agreement is in place, it doesn't mean if I'm an airline like Delta, I have to fly to that country, but I have the option to fly, just like they have the option to fly to the United States. So the thing that really raised its ugly head about a year ago, we did the story for CBS, was when the government of Abu Dhabi went to the United States Homeland Security folks and said, hey, can we build a customs facility in Abu Dhabi that would pre-clear U.S. passengers, not United States citizens per se, but anybody flying to the U.S. on our airlines, like they do in Canada, like they do in the Bahamas and Bermuda, and in many other countries, Ireland, and we'll build it to your security specifications, and we'll spend the money for it. And, of course, the United States said, sounds good to us because we don't spend the money. They spent all the money and built it. And then all the U.S. airlines, especially airlines like Delta, went nuts and said, hey, it's unfair. It's a disadvantage for us. You know, well, wait a minute. Not a single U.S. airline flies to Abu Dhabi. But they could under open skies, correct?
That's correct, and it would make it easier for people to come to the U.S. and easier for travelers. I mean, travelers, if we could move to pre-clearance all over the world, it'd be great for America because you wouldn't have the big long lines at Kennedy and Miami and L.A.
Well, you know, let's talk about pre-clearance because it's been around, people don't remember this, but it's been around since 1952, and it works. And everybody gets hung up on cost, but they don't understand how much it's worth when you actually start looking at the other costs that are ancillary and get kicked in there because of the delays caused when you don't have preclearance. So here's how preclearance works. You go to come home to the United States from Ireland. You actually clear U.S. Customs and Immigration in Ireland with a U.S. Customs and Immigration officer. Once you're cleared there, you get back on the plane or you board the plane, and when you land back in the U.S., you just go get your bags like anybody else. There's no customs. There's no long lines after an 11-hour flight or whatever it is. And if you're connecting, you just go to connect the flight, and your bags just connect. It saves so much money in terms of no misconnected passengers, no misconnected bags, fuel burn from airlines that are waiting to get cleared through customs. I mean, it all adds up. I can't imagine why we don't have preclearance in the really bigger chokehold airports. Oh, the choke point, oh, chokehold, yeah, right. Well, they become chokehold.
Yes.
Like London's Heathrow, Charles de Gaulle, even Milan.
It would be terrific. And it gives the opportunity to look at people in their country before they leave or the country where they're departing.
And you get the security done there before they even come to the United States.
Right. The poor
and it's our security.
Yes, and it's our people by our standards and our security. And the other thing you mentioned is missed flights. 20% of the people who make connections coming from international flight miss their connection.
And a lot of it's because of those long customs lines.
It's because of those long lines, and then they miss their cruise, and then they've got to try and catch up with the cruise ship maybe 2 days later. It's a real mess, and it's extremely costly to the airlines when they miss those connections because they've got to put them on another flight.
You've been so effective, Roger, with USTA in pushing the State Department to re-examine how we welcome visitors in this country and basically U.S. Customs and Border Patrol as well. You've been working so hard to get the visa wait times reduced, and they've been dramatically reduced, right? What are you coming up against in terms of pre-clearance?
Against pre-clearance, we're coming against our own carriers that don't want pre-clearance, especially in places where they don't have a dominant share of the market. And it's a real mistake. As I keep telling our carriers, international travel to the U.S. is going to grow by 40%. There's more than enough to go around. Our carriers grow by 3% a year. They can't keep up with the demand.
And not only that, there are fewer of them. I mean, we went from 8 major carriers now down to 4, right? If you include Southwest as the fourth carrier. They've consolidated their capacity. They've consolidated their route structure. They're making more money now than they've ever made in the entire history of the airline business dating back to the Wright brothers. And they're worried about being at a competitive disadvantage. People want to come to the United States now. Why can't we make it easier for them?
Right, and make no mistake, we want the U.S. carriers to be extremely profitable, healthy, and growing, no question about it, but not at the expense of the traveler. We're in a situation right now, you mentioned four airlines, but right now in 50% of the airports, one airline controls that airport. And once that one airline controls the airport, then they charge whatever they want. So they're also pushing to try and hold out low-cost carriers that want to come to the United States and make it very difficult for
like
people
Norwegian.
To get gates. Like Norwegian Air. A whole new set of passengers that would never be able to afford to come to the United States would come on Norwegian Air, but yet our own airlines are fighting them.
I can't see the logic here because it's a win-win for the airlines right now. I'm angry because when they had the opportunity to do so, in certain cases, the U.S. Justice Department never filed an antitrust case because the airlines always claimed that if we don't merge, we're each going to fail. And it was like, oh, my God, the sky is falling. And so everybody let them merge, and they let them consolidate. And now you're seeing so many cities in America talk about competitive disadvantage. How about just a total disadvantage because they don't have any air service?
Let me put it in perspective. Out of the 100 busiest airports, biggest airports in the United States, 70 have less capacity than they had in 2008. 70% of the airports, there are fewer seats. If you live in Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Memphis, Palm Springs, it's a real problem attracting businesses because they can't fly there, and it's hurtful to the U.S. economy. So we really need, I'm of the belief that a rising tide raises all boats, and the U.S. airlines should be participating to try and get as big a share as they can and compete and grow their stature, not keep people out.
Yeah, but you said the magic word, Roger, share. They're not interested in market share anymore. They're interested in yield. So that's why they're pulling out of all these other markets, because they have no need to compete anymore. If you're looking at Memphis and Cleveland and Cincinnati and Milwaukee and Kansas City and St. Louis, those are some of those 70% airports you mentioned that are way down in terms of service. They have a runway in St. Louis they don't even use anymore. It's a brand new runway they built because they thought they were going to get bigger.
And
they're not.
And when the airlines merged, if you go back to what they were saying 5 and 6, 7 years ago, it was the small regional communities are going to get more travel, more capacity, and it just hasn't happened.
Delta Airlines completely closed Comair. I think if American Airlines could sell American Eagle tomorrow, they'd do it in a heartbeat. I don't think they like the commuter airlines anymore. It's just a big mess. You know what? Pick an airport that gives you pre-clearance. You'll have so much better time getting back to the United States with such less stress.
Absolutely.
If you are sitting next to a small child or someone who is acting like a small child, please do us all a favor and put on your mask first.
My next guest, I can actually say he's been a regular on the show for quite some time. I've known him for really a long time.
Too long.
Thank you for that. He is the founder and the chairman, the chief executive officer of Abercrombie & Kent, otherwise known as Jeffrey Kent. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you, Peter, and good to see you.
You know, we never actually see each other anymore in Nairobi, which is where we first met. It's true, right? You're all over the world. Yes.
That's exactly where we were, on a safari.
That's right. And on the safari that I went with you guys, you did a Hemingway tented safari, and it was unbelievable because talk about luxe. Everybody had, I almost hesitate to say this because people are going to hate me for this, but I mean, everybody had their own butler, their own tent, their own hot water in the middle of the Mara. It was unreal.
Ice, martinis,
I was caviar. Asking you not to, I was hoping you wouldn't say that.
We probably didn't give you the caviar.
No, you didn't, no.
Everybody else got the caviar.
But let's talk about this in terms of the redefinition of the way people travel these days, especially with A&K, because you've done luxury trains. I remember doing a train with you guys called the Anna Karenina that went for that. Do you remember that train?
I remember it so well. And the Anna Karenina was a brilliant train.
It was a brilliant train. Yeah. They found all these amazing train cars that were on rail sidings, never used, built for the Tsars.
Yes.
You found them. You put them in, and you had it towed behind the old
The main freighters
that went right from Beijing to Berlin.
It was such a good trip.
And yet the only thing I had to tell you was I get on the train and it suddenly hits me. why would you call the train the Anna Karenina? Did you not read the book? How did she die at the end?
you know, the designer called it that, and I didn't have time to sort of double check it. And I asked that question halfway through. I'm reading the book, and I called my office and said, why do we call this train the Anna Karenina? But you know, we did a good job also with the Royal Scotsman. I built that train too.
Well, the Royal Scotsman preceded that because
I built that first, and then we came on with Anna Karenina second.
Yeah. But now you've taken that same approach and you've applied it to luxury jet travel.
Well, you know, I think the early Tent Safari, as you did it, and the beauty of that was we could go all over Africa before there were hotels, and we could stay anywhere we wanted. So we'd go to all the parks which had no hotels, and we went to Uganda, Murchison Falls, Queen Elizabeth Park, all over. So I said, in this modern day, what can I do to take people to all the places you can't get to, like Easter Island, Samoa, Papua New Guinea, Sri Lanka, Madagascar, Mongolia? And I had my map. I always had this map in my office, which when I'm bored, you know, which is not very often. But I look at the maps, I'd love to do this.
But you know what? You bring up an interesting point. I have a map in my office. In fact, it covers an entire wall of my office.
Me too.
And it's not about getting bored. I get inspired because I look at that map and I realize what we take for granted or what we have completely ignored. For example, if you look at the map of North America, we've heard about the Great Lakes. You know, you have all Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, right? Okay, I get that. But then look at the map again, and there's a body of water that nobody even realizes is there, which is five times larger than any of the Great Lakes. It's called Hudson Bay.
Yes.
And you're, oh my God, look at the size of this. And nobody's been there.
I know.
You know.
But that's what I think I get inspiration. I have an espresso, and I look at this, and I think, what am I going to do next? I've done trains, and suddenly hit me. Why don't I personalize a beautiful aircraft, put in 50 first-class seats, have them all made in Italy?
As you would.
As I would with burnished walnut, like in the Bentley, right? So it's all beautiful. Put in the best food, the best chefs, the best caviar, literally everything the best.
Yeah, I don't want that middle class caviar. I want the best caviar.
$800 bottle of wine and all that. And then why didn't I do what I did on Tent Safari? You're right. That was what I envisaged. So we took this plane and we did a trip last November. We left from Miami and we went to, first of all, the upper Amazon above Peru, you know, Peru.
Yes, of course.
And we caught anacondas, put them back again, of course, but, you know, crocodiles. We then went to Easter Island. We then went on to Papua New Guinea, up in the highlands, see the wigmen there. Have you done half of these trips?
I have,
Sepik Valley, then on to Sri Lanka. Oh, in between, we went to Komodo Island. Have you ever seen a Komodo dragon?
Of course.
He has seen them. This is going to be difficult. Okay, then you've been to Sri Lanka?
Yes, I have.
And you've climbed Sigiriya?
For those people who've never seen the Komodo dragon, go back and Netflix the movie My Freshman Year with Marlon Brando and the Komodo dragon. You'll see. But go ahead, yeah.
Okay. So then Sigiriya, we were in Madagascar?
Yes. Madagascar, the fourth largest island in the world.
Fourth largest island and has lemurs, which don't live anywhere
else. Yeah.
Oh, God, this is going to be a tough quiz.
Okay. No, I'm doing okay.
And so I plan the next one, which is leaving in May, which has already got four seats left. Out of 50. It was launched 2 weeks ago. 46 have gone, the four seats left.
Wow.
And that goes Easter Island, Solomon Islands. Have you been to Solomon Islands?
Yes, it's Guadalcanal.
Oh, my God. Okay. And then we're going to Rangiroa to dive for 3 days. Have you been to Rangiroa, French Polynesia?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Have you been to Mongolia?
I have.
Have you been down in the Gobi Desert?
I have not.
Okay. Have you seen the Nedem Festival?
No. Okay, well, you got me, Jeffrey. Okay.
No, okay. The Nedem Festival is another time of year. So I will actually pay for one, have my own private Nedem Festival in the Gobi Desert. How about that?
Not bad.
And then we go to Samarkand. You've been to Samarkand.
Yeah.
And then we go to Greenland.
Greenland is amazing. We've actually broadcast this show from Greenland, from Nook.
Wow.
And in fact, it was a satellite broadcast, probably the best reception, the clearest signal we've ever had because of where Greenland is. Once again, go look at the map. You want to see something that's huge and massive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so large, Greenland. It is so large.
And it is? And it is?
What?
And it is?
What?
The largest island in the world.
It is, yes, thank you.
Okay.
I know you're trying to help me there. I know. But, you know, you mentioned Easter Island a couple of times. There's a little-known airplane trip, speaking of airplane trips, that was done by Lon Chilley. They still do it.
Yeah.
It's a round-the-world trip around the Southern Hemisphere. So it starts in Santiago, Chile, goes to Easter Island, ends up in Sydney. It just stays south all the way around.
South.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And Tahiti. So it goes Sydney, Tahiti, Easter Island, Santiago.
Wow.
It's a cool thing. But you got to get off along the way. You just don't stay on the plane.
But, you know, the amazing thing about this trip was you'd have thought, and it took 23 days, and I decided to go on it myself, actually, because I thought, you know, I just want to make sure.
Well, it was the caviar and the burnished walnut. Come on.
Why wouldn't I, right?
Of course, yeah.
But it was amazing. We didn't have one squabble one argument from anybody for 23 days. Because why?
Because the alcohol.
No. The experience outweighed everything. And for once in my lifetime, people came for what I wanted with the experience. Not to grumble about the water's not hot, or this is not right, or breakfast was not on time.
There was no whining.
Not a moment of a whine. And it was so nice that everybody loved the experience, which is what I'm all about, as you know.
Well, what we're seeing now, and you can echo this, is that you can say what you want about the economies of the world or the comeback of the economies of the world, but the thing that comes back the first is travel, because people do not want to deny themselves those experiences.
No, and also, I met somebody on a beach the other day, actually down in Brazil, at Florianopolis, where I have a new home. Beautiful.
Florianopolis, by the way, was where we actually had the World Travel and Tourism Council a couple of years
exactly
ago.
Exactly.
And I had not been down there. Of course, I've been throughout Brazil, but never that part of Brazil. What an amazing place.
And I just bought a house, you know, my wife's Brazilian,
yes,
on Jurirê Beach. So it's a beautiful home right on the beach. And it's so nice. I like walking my dogs. And somebody stopped me and said, I think I know you. I said, really? I don't know. He said, no, it's something to do with travel. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm Abercrombie Kids. He said, exactly. My parents tell me that you're the only company they go with, all right? And I go with them, where they spend money and we get richer when we get back. We feel richer when we come back because they buy an experience.
I love it. Nothing that... A nice promotional statement.
Thank you very much.
No, I'm not done with you yet.
Oh, no, okay.
No, I am not done with you yet.
Okay.
Here we are in Madrid for the WTTC, yes, something that you've been involved in since day one. What changes are you
seeing? By the way, 25 years.
I know. Well, you and I go back almost that long with WTTC. Mm-hmm. I remember starting in Vancouver. We had a meeting in Vancouver, and then from then on.
I think my first one was with Jim Robinson and Colin Marshall, who brought me
Colin
in.
Colin Marshall from British Airways, Jim Robinson from American Express.
Exactly, and the American Airlines, Dick Crandall.
Right, Bob Crandall.
Bob Crandall.
Yes.
Thank you,
yes.
Bob Crandall. Yes,
he is still probably the most amazing airline executive I've ever met.
The best ever.
Yeah. And there are people, and he was hard. He was hard on everybody. But you know what? You talk to the employees of American Airlines, the longstanding pilots or flight attendants, they miss him.
He was the best.
Yeah.
Him and Colin Marshall.
Yeah, exactly.
They were the best.
But what do you see as a major change happening in travel right now?
Well, I think, you sit in all the WTTC meetings, and the biggest change everybody talks about all the time is social media. What's it doing? It's a disruptor. It's going to wreck our travel. And I think, but you have to be very, as came out yesterday, you have to be very, very nimble.
Yes.
And so some people get nimble by going downwards, cutting prices, doing this, doing more. I get nimble by going upwards.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.
If you like Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Survivor's back, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist, a new co-host, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
Hi!
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.